Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 2nd of April. Very nice to have you with us. The music we're playing this morning is that of Fountains of Wayne singer and songwriter and co-founder Adam Schlesinger, who died yesterday at the age of 52. He died as a result of coronavirus complications. We'll be playing Adam Schlesinger music this morning. Just after Sarah, Mike Bowen and I were kind of working on the music last night, and then about 10 minutes after we got done with it, we realized we found out that Ellis Marsalis passed away. So we will remember Ellis Marsalis tomorrow with music, but today we remember Adam Schlesinger, who again died yesterday at the age of 52. We have a lot to talk about. We have a wonderful panel, and we'll get to everybody here. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We just ask that you keep them short and to the point. We do have a number of letters each day. We just have hundreds and hundreds of letters that are coming in these days, and people are home, and they're writing, and we love that. We want to get to as many as possible. So please, whatever you can do to make them short, we appreciate that. Let me introduce the group, and we will get started. WAMC's Alan Chartak, how are you this morning?
Good morning, my dear friend. We are, as you know, we talk all the time,
yes,
before, after, and during the show, and we're happy to be here.
It is. It's good to do this and to have this conversation with everybody. We are very, very happy to have our good friend Philip Glotzbach back. He is the Skidmore College president, and he joined us last week. He is with us this week, and we are very, very pleased to welcome him back to the program. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. Very happy to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you with us. Investigative journalist in New Albany. No, that's not. Is Rosemary with us? No, Rosemary isn't with us. I have this wrong. We have Vera today. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
The script, I wrote the script and it's wrong. Okay. in fact, I got a lot wrong in the script. I have three names that aren't here. Hold on. All right, there we go. Jim.
Yesterday's script.
It is. No, I think it may be last Thursday's script. It's the cut and paste thing that screwed me up. Vera Carius Kelly is here. She is a professor of comparative politics at the college named Siena College in Loudonville, New York. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm great. I'm actually grateful I'm back on the radio. It's fun to connect with everyone.
Well, it's very nice to have you again. Thank you very much for being with us. We also welcome Jim Henler, Tetherless World Professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in the Departments of Computer Science. I have your full title here, but not on the script that I have, Jim. So
that was fine, Jim.
It's Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI and Director of the RPI-IBM Artificial Intelligence Research Collaboration. There you go. I want to give you your due. Thank you very much. All right. Again, panel@wamc.org is where you send your letters, and we will get to those in just probably 15 minutes or so. Let's go over what is happening in the world. There are many stories. We will do a quick rundown of what's happening. I should note that the story that just broke before we went on is unemployment. 6.6 million people, staggering number of people, claiming jobless benefits, setting a new record for the second week in a row. Much of the country has been ordered to stay at home, bringing the economy to a lurching halt. So that is 6.6 million people filing for unemployment over the past week. Also, other stories, of course, and big things having to do with coronavirus. We are finding out many many things. Of course, by the way, the full report will be coming out. The full jobless report will come out tomorrow. In other news, thousands of ventilators in a government stockpile are unusable after a maintenance contract lapsed last year. Federal officials said on Wednesday that their reserves of medical gear were nearly completed. They have really nothing left. The economic crisis had led Washington to resurrect a multi-trillion-dollar infrastructure plan, which could create thousands of jobs.
Social Security beneficiaries who don't typically file tax returns will automatically receive the $1,200 relief payments authorized by Congress after the Treasury Department reversed earlier guidance, which would have required them to do a bit more paperwork and a bit more work with the Social Security office. That is no longer necessary, apparently. Meanwhile, expecting a surge in virus patients, New York City's public hospital system plans to convert all of its facilities to intensive care units. Patients who do not have the virus will be sent to temporary hospitals or improvised medical facilities. France is emerging as a test case of whether a government can speed an economic recovery by paying businesses to not lay off workers. That is another story. Meanwhile, former Vice President Joe Biden is calling for moving the Democratic National Convention to August from mid-July. The Republican Party is still planning the convention in late August. And I think we'll stop there. There are many other things going on, but we can get to those a little bit later. Those are the main headlines. Alan, what do you make of any or all of those?
Well, first of all, the idea of putting the convention's office, it seems to me, is an excellent one. I think it has to be done. And you don't want to put people in a room. We know that in New York State, they're really basically calling it off, the Democratic convention. Why would you put anybody at risk? It can all be done virtually. And nature abhors a vacuum, and the vacuum right now is what we see in the way in which we can't put people in a room, so it's going to have to be virtual, and we're going to have to invent ways to do that. Joe, I did want to say one thing, and maybe a little off topic, but I did want to compliment our listenership. I love them all. We know that we have a lot more people listening now than ever before. But one of the things that is so extraordinary about them is that each of us are on our home phones. We're in a different place, and yet I get lots of critical letters about lots of things, but I have not seen a single person say, can't you have better phone lines? Because I think everybody gets it. And so I just want to stop there and move on to the next.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Philip Glotzbach, what do you make of the litany of stories I read earlier?
That's a big question. I was just going to comment, Joe, that you've managed to have an all-academic panel here today, and that's rather dangerous. So
I know.
Congratulations, for being courageous.
I was thinking when I actually had the right list of panelists in front of me last night, I thought, this is pretty cool. We have just the smartest and most incredible people all together. I hope we all can get a moment to talk. But go ahead.
So Phil, why don't you bring us up to date on what you see, because it's a great crisis. It's enough to make the front page of the Times, I believe, to what's happening to America's academic institutions.
Well, it is, and the other folks on the panel can certainly comment as well. The colleges and universities were among the first businesses to shut down. We really, virtually everybody, except for Liberty University, and even now they're under an order from the Virginia governor that I think will prohibit them from reopening the way they'd planned. But colleges and universities across the country closed their campuses, emptied them out. Most of us were engaged in face-to-face, more or less traditional education before that moment, and we've asked our faculty members to switch to remote learning, which is a huge undertaking, and people have done it, and not just at Skidmore, but across the country. And again, Jim and Vera can talk about how it's going at their mm-hmm. schools. And the other part, just very quickly, and then I'll be quiet, there's a huge economic impact because basically what's happening is colleges and universities have their full payroll. Everybody, I think, is pretty much trying to, if they can, to continue paying faculty members and staff members, even people who aren't able to work remotely. But without students on campus, I think virtually all of us feel some obligation to return a portion of the room and board. At Skidmore, that's about $4.5 million, which is certainly not trivial. And at some schools with smaller budgets and schools that are closer to economic, catastrophe, shall we say, this could be a death blow. So I was very pleased that the relief bill included $14 billion for colleges and universities. It's not enough, but that is money to help make up for some of this lost revenue.
Yeah, we were. I do want to talk about that later. We have. I want to bring that up about the not being enough. As far as some of the other things that I mentioned, and just overall, overall, Philip, of the of what we're looking at in terms of. The death toll, the inability to get the necessary supplies, the response. What do you make of all that?
Well, I have no privileged position to comment on that, but I'm looking at the news along with everybody else, and I think what we're looking at here is a failure of planning. And I said this before, it's difficult for democracies to plan in advance for unlikely but potentially disastrous events. After the event happens, we look back and say, why didn't we see this? We should have seen this. People had warned about it. There were preparatory agencies involved, some of which had been dismantled in this administration. We have not moved, I think, effectively enough to manage the supply of the necessary goods and services that our medical personnel require. We received at Skidmore a request from the Saratoga Hospital for personal protective gear, and we contributed what we could find that we had, and I'm sure other schools have done the same. So it's sad that in the midst of this crisis, the medical community is basically going begging, for any possible source of the materials they need to keep the people on the front lines protected. So
let me ask you.
Can
I just ask a question of the panel, and that is it appropriate to hold Donald Trump responsible for his errors, as putting off this whole thing, for his mistruths, or is it this, as he claims, a time for all Americans to get together and forget about politics?
Like to comment on that.
Yeah, but before you do, we have an election coming up. That's the only thing that I'm going to say. And go ahead, Vera.
Yeah, so I wanted to say that as a comparativist, obviously I pay very close attention to how planning happens in other countries. And I must say, we call it a strategic national stockpile because we have entire teams of medical experts, military thinkers, groups of think tank policy, public policy think tank people get together constantly, and as well as scientists, thinking through all of the potential dangers that could be faced by the United States and its population. And it is utterly shocking how unprepared this administration has been to address the gaps and the lack of materials that are in the strategic national stockpile. It is criminal. And I hold this administration and its lack of preparedness responsible for some of the deaths and some of the chaos we now see at our hospitals and among nursing facilities, for example.
Yes, but so, the question for you, just one second here, Rivera. So the question is, can we afford to have politics at a time of crisis?
To be absolutely honest, it does not help right now to simply say this administration is to blame. We, of course, now need to call on everyone in the United States to help out. Now we're responsible for, I'm so thankful. I have a neighbor two houses down, Amy Klugman, who herself sews face masks for friends, neighbors, and nurses. But, I mean, when you think about it, how shocking is it that a country like the United States must rely on individuals and wonderful activist friends to produce such materials for our nurses and for our physicians? Mm. How is this possible? It is wonderful to hear those stories and uplifting, and I thank them all. However, the responsibility for protecting everyone in this country is with the local, state, and federal government. And if the federal government does not provide backup and assistance to the states in trouble, what kind of a country do we live in? I mean, this is shocking. What we see is a shocking level of unpreparedness.
Jim Handler.
So can I take it to a slightly different level? Mm-hmm. You know, I have a visceral reaction every time I see people specifically banging on Trump, who deserves it. But yes, you know, there's a certain amount of putting politics behind us, except, Alan, I think it's the bigger picture of that, right? This administration is the result of a lot of years of big C conservatism that said small government, local government, reduce taxes, rich people deserve what they have and don't need to share, right? And, you know, many of us have been saying, including you, that, you know, that's fine on a day-to-day when everything is great, but the minute something bad starts to happen, that's going to be when all
hell,
when the stuff that would cause Joe to hit the button hits
yes.
the fan.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the proof of the pudding, that this whole approach that led to Trumpism, this whole approach that led to the Tea Partyism, is killing people. So, you know, whether it's focused on the specific election or the general politics, mm-hmm. I think we see suddenly the importance that has been there for the national government, for that organization that is competent and well organized and able to deal with things.
Yeah,
and that has been broken.
So wait, but what you are saying, and I certainly agree with it if I'm hearing you correctly, no, you can't in a democracy put politics aside, because important decisions have to be made by us. Is that right?
Yes, I'm agreeing with you, but I'm saying, but you know, I think it's more than I think it's even more than just, is Trump to blame? Is this person doing the right thing? What's going to happen to Fauci if he badmouths Trump? I worry about all those things. But I think the bigger thing is the notion that, I forget whose quote it is, sorry, but, you know, that government should be the size where we could put it in a bathtub and drown it, right? Well, guess what?
Yeah.
You know, we're there and we're drowning. You know, when a crisis hits,
Jim,
you need a government.
I need to take a break, but we'll come back and we'll continue our conversation. We welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue our conversation after this news break. It's 9:04. It is a Thursday morning, April 4th, and we welcome you back to the roundtable. Vera Karius, Kelly, Jim Handler, Philip Glotzbach, and Alan Chartok. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to some of the letters, and we begin with Barbara, who said, you know, I live in a small college town, and I'm terrified of students from all over the country and the world returning to our tiny community in September. Philip, is that something that obviously you've had to deal with?
It is. I mean, that was one of the reasons why we closed. And again, I'm sure it's true for other schools as well. We closed the campus because we did not want a population of students coming back from all over the world, literally, and living here in close quarters. I mean, a residence hall is kind of like a landlocked cruise liner. And, you know, we see what happens on cruise ships, and it's not pretty. Let's hope that in September we're in a different place. It's, you know, who knows where we will be.
Right.
But, you know, if we are in that different place, it might be less of an issue, but people will still worry about it.
Rich writes to us and says, why is the Trump administration not willing to coordinate the purchase and distribution of personal protective equipment? Is this a states' rights philosophy? Alan.
Well, you know, it is. We do have federalism and the sharing of power between the federal government and the states. Some people take it, some people don't. The disgrace in Florida with DeSantis was has been nothing short of terrible. But the leadership here in New York by Cuomo has been exemplary as to how this thing can be done. We certainly don't have a I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was thinking, you know, I agree with you. Federalism has very little to do with it because, you know, Germany has a federal system and it's highly efficient in terms of its distribution, right? So it is a decision by the top and it's very politicized decision-making by individual governors, like you said, in Florida. DeSantis is clearly trying to sort of, you know, keep close to Trump and his original ideas and ideology about how to respond to a pandemic. And that is the pain that we now see and will see in the coming months. And it's the first indicator that we have now that neoliberalism is hurting us. Mm. It excludes this sort of really hardcore capitalist approach. It excludes protections for our human resources. And that is a shocking reality for many of us in the United States, a country that claims to be a true democracy and an inspiration to others.
Jim Handler.
We certainly have a federal government that can override states when in emergency. We have significant amounts of control. There's certainly, if nothing else, the bully pulpit. You know, I have not heard Trump say at any of his briefings that he would like to see a national, you know, self-distancing or stay-at-home order. In other words, forget the order. He has basically published this, here's what I think people should do thing, and said, leave it to the individual states and governors to do what they want. Again, it's that lack of belief in a federal government. It's the dismantling of that federal government we need. You know, you've heard me on this show before talk about some of the issues I've faced working with the Department of Homeland Security. I'd love to see those guys out in the lead here, working with FEMA hand in hand to solve this. The people aren't there to do it, even if they had the federal government's permission to move ahead with that. So the system got broken by a philosophy that we're now dealing with. I don't think there's a solution other than the government to take control. You know, the president talks to governors every day. When he finally said through a spokesperson that maybe it would be a good idea for governors to do things, that's when Florida turned around.
But the irony here,
Alan?
Jim, the irony here is we have a president who, along with the Supreme Court justices who he's appointed, believes in maximizing governmental presidential power, leadership power. And yet, when it comes down to really using it for the people, he doesn't. I remember when Jack Kennedy, I remember this pretty well, decided that the steel companies had overstepped themselves, as I remember it. And he jawboned them, and everybody said, oh, that's not his power. But he did it. But this president isn't doing that.
Yeah, if he was worrying less about his popularity and more about the country, he could be making statements that would have impact. The Republican governors are taking their lead from him. The red states are taking their lead from him. And his saying, you guys make your own decisions, is leaving them to make their own decisions, which is a bad idea.
The best example of that, of course, being Florida. We got this letter from Peter who says state and federal governments need to work with hospitals to establish and fund lodging, hotels, et cetera, for medical workers following their work shift. This is vital to protect workers' families and also to promote the isolation protocol, which is the only way to slow the virus spread. This letter obviously points out what has become apparent, that those who are on the front lines, the hospital workers, the ones who are taking care of those who are sick and who are dying, are also, in many cases, are the ones who are coming down with the virus in just unheard of numbers.
Yes. For example, here where I live, I'm part of a neighborhood application where we share news, and there was a request that we received if anybody had additional housing available for local medical staff that couldn't go home and had to sleep in their cars because they didn't want to infect their families.
Right. And that's a story we're hearing over and over again. And of course, in the city, it's much worse because it's difficult to do that. JP brings up an interesting point and says, can the panel discuss the president's news conference yesterday? I would just like to point out yesterday, of course, we were told that this was going to be an update of from the White House task force on the coronavirus. Instead, it was on the fighting of Latin American drug cartels. So JP's question is, can you talk about the news conference in which the sycophants fawned over Trump for his leadership, quote unquote, in deciding suddenly to send troops to Latin America? What? There's nothing else we should be spending money on right now? Diversion much? Alan?
You know, I'm fascinated by the news conferences, by the president's conferences, because I think that the press corps, for their part, are doing the right thing. They are staying away from this pompous fellow and who's just a chest beater. And what they're doing is they're asking Fauci and the other guys their opinions, the scientists, for the scientific opinion, and he can't stand it. It's amazing the way he pushes his way back in after he's had enough of them answering scientific questions, especially when he won't answer questions like, is it all right to have a church which brings all kinds of people which will infect each other together? He doesn't want to touch that one with a 10-foot pole because that's his constituency. Interesting stuff.
Anybody else on the drug cartel?
Well, I think I agree that it's a redirect, and he wants to prove once again that he is the man in charge, and he thinks broadly about the safety of Americans, when in fact what we see is that he's not figuring out what is the essential approach to preventing this pandemic to spread and to last for a much longer time. So I agree with, I think it was JP who said that this is likely a way to sort of redirect America's attention to some other danger coming from, you know, the South, from Latin America, as always. People from elsewhere bring all the problems to us rather than reflecting on what is going on inside the country.
But I think the most disturbing part about that yesterday was that it was hijacking what was on everybody's mind, which was, and I mean, this is the diversion part of it, but we now have 5,137 deaths in this country. We have over 216,000 cases of the virus. So the fact that that isn't even mentioned, and the scientists aren't even there. We're bringing in other people. It obviously has nothing to do with the virus at that point, and it is a diversion. But it's also not giving us the information that people are craving, which is more information on what's happening and the response.
Joe, he can't win on this. They've tried to position him so that he could be a leader in the antiviral movement, but it's turning out, of course, nothing to do with the reality, because we know that at least one person has put together a montage of all of his lies. You know, lying about what caused this, it's a Democratic hoax, it's only 15 people in the United States. And what I've heard is he's doing everything in his power to get that taken down. So the idea, of course, would be to divert, because he's giving up on being seen as a leader in this antiviral thing when everybody knows he was in large part responsible for dragging our heels on this.
Jamie writes, well, it is clear now that everyone is wrong about what kind of health care we need. We need a worldwide health care system that guarantees to every human prompt and safe health care at no cost. That includes shelter and safe food and water, because anything else than that will cost us all more than we could ever imagine losing. We go to Michael, who makes two points. Michael says, I guess during these times we can't pick and choose where we get medical aid from, but receiving aid from Russia is very unsettling for a number of reasons. Vera, anything on that?
Well, I mean, I find it also astounding that we still have the general posture of being the most advanced country when it comes to medical issues, yet we receive aid from others. We officially reject assistance and medical information, except for, of course, the scientists. The scientists are all collaborating. I can't say enough about scientific communities, especially in terms of inoculation, immunization programs, and all the research that is shared with, you know, taking down all the boundaries that have existed so far. But on a governmental level, it is shocking, for example, that tests for the coronavirus, simple, quick tests that have existed for almost 6 weeks now in Germany, were simply rejected for introduction in this country, when in fact the U.S. government wanted to have its own labs, U.S. labs, develop a test. Why? Why not use existing tests that are also used by the World Health Organization? That is pure horror to me when I hear that.
Let me pick up on what Vera's saying here. I think many people have said what we need here is a Manhattan Project to address this thing, and I absolutely would have agreed with that. I mean, I think that would be a role that our federal government could and should play. But what we are seeing and what she was referencing is this unprecedented worldwide global Manhattan Project that the scientific community is now engaged in to address this issue, and that's heartening. And I think what we have here, and Jim would know more about this than I am, but I think this is the realization of the promise of the internet that started really in 1966 with ARPANET. I mean, people thought, gee, if we could just bring people together, we could solve problems and people could create communities where there are boundaries and so on. And we've seen the downside of that with what happens in social media. But this effort by scientists worldwide that is yielding results. I mean, the salvation for all of us in this thing is going to be the development of a vaccine that at least will provide some protection, one would hope, and at least, or lessen the severity of the disease. So I think that's one hopeful sign or moment in this terrible crisis. It's too bad the federal government is not taking more of a leadership role, but in a way, the scientific community is bypassing all governments to have its own Manhattan Project.
Jim, be a spokesman for that scientific community, if you will.
Sure. You know, I mean, one of the things that I'm very involved in and that I found very encouraging is a voluntary program that's now going nationwide. It was proposed by IBM, moved up to the Office of Science and Technology Policy, but basically everybody with a major supercomputer, with big cloud computing capabilities, et cetera, are now donating time free. Normally that's quite expensive, to try every technique we can think in the book to deal with this thing. We are making supercomputers available for artificial intelligence research and things that we have a whole new toolkit that wasn't here in past epidemics, and we're really working hard to look at it. What I will say though is, and you know, I won't make this a long conversation, but the scientific community is also discovering we have to reinvent some ways of working. We're so used to computer scientists do computer scientists and medical people do medical and this person does this and this business. We are now seeing teams of social scientists, computer scientists, you know, epidemiologists, molecular biologists starting to work together and ignoring things like, will this get me tenure? And, you know, is this the right publication? And focusing on, will this cure people? So it's exciting to see a culture change in action. We need a lot more of it, and we need a lot more of it faster. But at the high end of research, people really are taking seriously that we must work together worldwide and get this thing behind us.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have many more letters. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Well,
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Vera Carius Kelly, Jim Hendler, and Philip Glotzbach. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Back to the letters we go. Jeff says, Trump yesterday said his biggest disappointment about this entire pandemic was that the churches wouldn't be full on Easter. He said it twice. Never mind 200,000 people who could be dead. Mark says, Switzerland has a very strong and independent system held together as loose federation. As a loose federation, the Swiss federal government almost immediately federalized a coordinated response to coronavirus. Vera.
Yes, I mean, a lot of countries that have federal systems in Europe have attempted to give direct orders from the top, but then let each state or each canton in Switzerland decide what its specific needs are per region for hospital and healthcare workers. So that system can work if you get direction from the top. The Swiss have done okay with that system. The Germans have done really well. Both the Swiss and the Germans have also other advantages. They have societies where people are actually showing still quite a bit of respect for the leadership shown by the federal structure in place. So that helps when it comes to social distancing and disallowing people from visiting their elders in nursing homes and separating young people from grandparents and creating those kinds of structures. Of course, having a generally wealthy society also helps because you have smaller family units and more opportunity to actually separate.
Let's go back to the letters and to David, who said we should hold Trump accountable for the level of disarray the federal government is in regarding the emergency response to the epidemic. He has actively worked against a focused, informed, and centralized response for selfish political reasons. Alan, do you think that'll come back to bite him?
Yes, I think it already has bitten him to some degree. Now, look, we do know his numbers are going up. The numbers have gone up because people are looking for leadership, any kind of leadership in this mess. And I'm afraid that Joe Biden is not taking advantage of that in terms of creating an understanding of what the difference between him and Trump is. I'm not happy about it, but that's just the way it is. No, I think he has to be held responsible, and that's why I asked that question so much earlier in this program.
Right.
That we have a politics, and this is a terrible time, and people ought to be noticing it and taking advantage of the electoral system that we have.
What's also...
So can I
go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you a question. You know, one of the things I'm hearing a lot of people saying is, where is Obama? Do you think he's right to stay quiet and try to stay out of things? And I don't mean, you know, pushing Biden or anything, but really talking about the importance of national leadership. Some people say there that he's just afraid that would wind up Trump. Other people are saying other things. I'm just curious, you know, have you
I truly believe, Jim, that he's going to be there. But he's waiting for that moment when it'll really have impact and make a difference. And that will be during that cycle, which brings on the election itself. He'll be there and he'll really be forceful, I'm sure. But he just thinks it's inappropriate to waste it now. That's been my feeling from the very beginning.
He has been speaking out somewhat. There was a story yesterday that it took a swipe at the president in saying that we've seen all too terribly the consequences of those who denied warnings of a pandemic. He tweeted that yesterday without directly naming the president. But Jim, I assume you're looking for a lot more than that.
Yeah, I mean, again, it wasn't that I'm looking for. I was actually curious. I think Alan makes a very good point that saving your big guns for the right time might be important.
All right.
Well, also, maybe I could say something else. I agree with Alan that Obama will step up when the time is right. Now, the time will be right when the Democrats actually have to present a forward-looking notion. You can't just win an election by critiquing the current administration. So what has to happen is a really clearly articulated sense of hope once again for this country once we come out of this pandemic or once we lay out economic recovery plans. So simply saying this administration has failed will not convince some of the sort of center-right voters who are still sort of hanging in there and hoping that they will not be affected by this pandemic. So the economic conversation about how to get back on track, how to recreate the United States in a better way is what will attract voters to the Democratic Party if they can manage.
So, Vera, do you think that this president is going to be held responsible in any part for what's happened in this pandemic?
He will, especially if he is promising so many things. Now, obviously, the conversation about the infrastructure bill is all about positioning himself for the future. Now, he wants to be the hero who rebuilds America. Now, the way he wants to rebuild America might exclude health care options for a lot of people or true aid for small businesses that is more long-term, or unemployment insurance, or connecting a sort of broadband connections to more remote areas. Those are really, really important issues to consider in this country. Now, he wants to build roads and bridges because that's a way to be able to talk about enormous projects and rebuilding. But that rebuilding can be the focus for the Democrats. They need to think much more broadly to be able to critique this president if he wants to, you know, if he wants to win another period as another 4-year period as the American president, he will have to be much more broadly focused than on roads and bridges.
Alan, when you talk about the responsibility and being held responsible, do you mean by the voters or further than that?
No, I mean by the voters. I mean by the Democrat. In a democratic system, voters get a choice. And the question is, how do you frame it? How do you bring it on? When do you, at what point do you say, okay, we're holding you responsible? If you do it too early, forget it. It's old news. So I think it's a matter of staging this thing.
I agree.
Yeah, I think that's right. The you know, this is a moment for complex thought, and it's we're not very good at that in this country in the public domain. It is a moment in some ways to rise above politics. And if we don't do that, we're all going to fail together. We haven't really quite achieved that yet on the national level or even some of the state levels, but at least people are talking about it. There will be a moment, I think, for looking back on this. And there are two ways to regard that. One way is to say, well, holding people responsible, which I think is important, Alan, I would agree with you that we need to do that. But at the same time, we need to look back and say, okay, so what can we learn from this? You know, where did things go wrong? What could have helped us before this pandemic wound up? But come back to Jim's earlier point about the larger question about the most effective form of government. Is it, and it was Grover Norquist, by the way, who said you should shrink government so you could drown it in a bathtub.
Norquist, yes.
You know, I mean, that has been a major tenet in American thought going back to the 50s. Ronald Reagan was an articulate spokesperson for that position. And I agree. I think it has damaged us. And when people attack public servants or the notion of that civil service is just something we can do without, we see what happens when we gut the agencies that are in charge of protecting our health and safety. So I do think that it's time after this is passed and we get to the next political moment to have that larger conversation about, well, what is the role of the federal government in American life? That conversation has been sort of on the periphery in the last few years. It would be nice to bring it to the fore and really engage it.
And you know, Phil, one other thing following up on that, and that is, it's not only the actors themselves, the political actors, but it is us. It's how many constituencies are making their voices heard. We all know that if everybody voted, 50% don't, for a president, there would never be a Republican president. You wouldn't find it. But the fact of the matter is, the people who need the work, who need the help the most, are strangely silent. And that is a very disappointing part of what we're going through.
I'm going to pause.
Well, in a democracy, we are collectively responsible. That's just the way it is. We have to accept it.
We are. Phil is right. We have had an ideology in this country that says, if you are struggling economically, pull yourselves up by the bootstraps and do it. And if you don't do it, then there must be something wrong with you. Either you're not working hard enough, or you are not innovative enough, or you are not effective, or you're doing something wrong. And that is, in essence, the message that has permeated this country and created devastating ripple effects for those that feel on the margins of society. And I think Trump was able to sort of talk to all these people early on and say, I'm going to create a new America for you. It's worked for a certain group, but let's see if that kind of thinking changes with the depth of this pandemic and the economic devastation that we will see in the coming months.
We are desperately late for a break, about 4 minutes, actually. So I need to do that before the FCC comes and says, hey, why didn't you play the ID? You're come with us. We will do that, and then we'll go to news, and we'll be back right after this.
And you're a dreamer just like me. We don't need reality. We're in our own world. We're in our own world. We're in our own world.
That's a song from the Monkees that we're playing that was written by Adam Schlesinger, a musician and songwriter who was a member of Fountains of Wayne and who died at the age of 52. People have been asking about the music. We have a full playlist on our website, wamc.org/roundtable. So we welcome you back. We have a wonderful panel here, Alan Chartok, Vera Carius-Kelly, Jim Hendler, and Philip Glotzbach. We welcome your letters, panel at wamc.org. I want to start off this half hour with this story. China has concealed the extent of the coronavirus outbreak in its country, underreporting both total cases and deaths it suffered from the disease. The U.S. intelligence community has concluded this in a classified report to the White House, according to three U.S. officials. The officials asked not to be identified because the report is secret and they declined to detail its contents. But the thrust, they say, is that China's public reporting on cases and deaths is intentionally incomplete. Two of the officials said the report concludes that China's numbers are fake. Jim Hendler, let me go to you on this and your concerns in hearing this report.
Thanks, Joe. You know, I actually got wind that this might be happening about 3 weeks ago now. I got an email from a colleague of mine at Wuhan who said that, you know, their morgue was had like 40,000 bodies. And, you know, this was far more than usual, et cetera, et cetera, and really reflected numbers that he wasn't seeing. And his belief was that because of the authoritarian government, and we've heard this happen before in other places, and it certainly was part of what happened throughout, the local governments were scared to tell the truth to the national government. So he didn't think that it was the Chinese central government causing the problem, but rather that the local governments weren't telling the truth. And frankly, that worried me for a lot of reasons. One is just we've been trusting their data on the flattening, and if it's wrong, so a lot of our thinking about how transmissible the disease is and how deadly it is come from China's numbers, and now finding those numbers may be misleading is very worrisome from a data point of view. But then personally, I find it very worrisome because we're seeing the same thing in the U.S. Our national reporting of these numbers, you know, how many have died, things like that, are coming, I think, and not in this case so much from people hiding information, but from that same dysfunction we've been talking about. There's not a national reporting system. There's not something that says everybody must report, you know, this number here and this number here. You know, where are recoveries being reported? It's a total mess. And, you know, this is sort of the ultimate big data problem. And when the data is wrong, it's bad. And you know, if our numbers are bad because of disorder, we put those together with China's numbers, which are bad because of authoritarianism. We put that together with numbers coming out of places like Italy and South Korea, where we've seen good trends, but often, you know, it's hard to compare someplace like South Korea, where they tested literally everyone, with other places where they're so overwhelmed, we don't even know what percent. So it's frustrating.
Alan?
Now we have this megalomaniacal president who wanted to keep the economy open. President Xi in China, I said before these microphones, who remembers that I didn't trust those numbers one bit? And I said so a long time ago because he makes up what his needs are. The president of the United States sees the economy going into the tank, sees his election going into the same tank, and he can't handle it. But he does not live in a total authoritarian state as the Chinese do. So I think that's part of it. I wish I could believe what Jim says, that it's really a matter of reporting from the localities to the national government. I don't. I think that this comes from the top down, as everything in that country does.
But don't you think, I mean, to Jim's point, though, isn't there a concern that, let's just say, the governor of a red state, perhaps, does not give the numbers that are truly accurate as to appease the president?
It's possible, but I think that there are so many. I think there are so many more stop gaps here. So many more ways of holding people responsible. Sorry,
but I don't think it's so much the accuracy.
Let's go to Jim first, and then we'll go to Vera. Go ahead.
Sorry, I don't think it's so much the accuracy. You know, I don't think it's the governor is going to lie, but I think, for example, we don't know how many tests were given in different places, and if reporting it one way makes it look better and reporting it another way makes it look worse, you know, and Governor Cuomo is trying to tell the truth and some other governor isn't doing the extra work to find the numbers, then we're putting things that don't match together and coming up with conclusions that could really be dangerous.
Vera.
So I agree 100% with Jim. The point that we have to keep in mind is that certain governors prefer not to test the population so their numbers are lower. That is what is happening in this country. We have extensive reporting from China where lower-level administrators and health officials punished physicians for speaking up on social media on coronavirus early on, and they provided misleading information to the top. Now, did the top leadership in China again meddle with the numbers? Certainly possible. But here is what we have to think about. Without clear measures to test as many people in this country as we possibly can, we will never have clarity on how many people are infected, and we also will not know of what causes people die. That is why it is so essential to look at some of the more reliable countries in Western Europe to get our numbers for comparative, for modeling. Without that, we don't know what's happening in this country.
Philip,
yeah, let me just.
Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, we're making two really important points here. There's one way to conceal the truth, and that is to have some governmental imposition that says don't tell the truth. And the other way is just not to look for it. And it's very difficult to find data. You have to work at it. And so if we don't have structures in place to do it, and this is what our colleagues on the panel are saying, I was just going to make a third point that if you want a small ray of hope here, it's becoming in this world much more difficult to conceal information longer. If there was a time when you'd have to go back and, you know, historians would have to sort through records and boxes of paper to find out what the real numbers were. Well, we're in a world now where this information, as Jim said, he got an email from his colleague in China, information can get out. Now, it can be swamped by the disinformation that's awash, you know, the internet's awash in disinformation. But at least there is, it's harder to suppress information today than it was, say, 20 years ago.
Let's go to the letters. We have many, and I'll try to get to as many as I can here. Mark says, regarding preparedness, nobody disagrees that we're facing a large number of virus deaths, but are we prepared to dispose of an additional 100,000, the best case scenario, or 240,000 bodies? A grim question, but certainly one that obviously will have to be taken into account if that is achieved. Michael says, one can argue that mental health is equally or more important than physical health. Everything starts with the mind. Any rational individual who has seen the actions and behaviors of this administration over the last 3.5 years would certainly agree. Lynn says, anyone who has a training in emergency response will tell you a centralized distribution point for essential equipment is required. Initial response is required at the state level, but having the PPE and respirators to support the state's needs is where our current federal government has failed all of us.
Exactly, because that's why it's called the Strategic National Stockpile, of which neither we have a stockpile nor do we think strategically about this pandemic.
Donna says, I'm no scientist and I know you guys aren't doctors, but somewhere along the way I learned that there is good bacteria and bad bacteria. We're killing off all the good bacteria with all the sanitizing. Could this become an issue in the future? Anyone on that? Jim, go ahead.
Sanitizers are not good generally because we're facing a pandemic now. That is a more imminent threat than the current discussion on bacteria, is my view. But Jim is the scientist.
Jim, go ahead.
More or less the same answer with a lot of different bigger words, but actually the really fast
we like big words.
But the really fast thing about it is, the most effective thing against this particular kind of virus is actually soap, not sanitizer.
Yes.
And soap has much less impact overall. Mm-hmm. So please, mm-hmm. please, everybody, wash your hands.
I don't know about you guys, but I'm doing what I'm told. And I'm told to wash my hands. So I'm washing my hands. And yeah, you could scratch your head and say there are 1,000 things that could go wrong with that advice, but hey, that's the advice, and
that's right.
Who am I to argue with it?
Just remember,
you know,
don't forget your thumbs and between your fingers. Go ahead,
that's
Jay.
Right. It won't, you know, it's not the panacea, it's not the magic bullet, but I'll tell you, it's more effective than just about anything else other than staying home. So stay home and wash your hands, and you're doing pretty much all you can right now.
Nick writes to us and says, Trump stated in yesterday's blackout of the 6 o'clock news, during which he meanders around and repeats himself like a senile grandparent, that we're buying a massive quantity of hospital gowns from Walmart. Is this a gift to a donor and a sign to his followers? Why wouldn't federal procurement just buy needed goods direct from manufacturers? I don't shop at Walmart, but I doubt that these gowns are a standard item. What are your thoughts, panel?
As a grandfather, I take issue with that.
Me too. and think who we're talking about. I mean, you know, with everything we know about this guy, should it shock you that he's helping a contributor?
Well, right. But the question about the procurement and getting it from, of why can't the federal government get these instead of going to Walmart to get them? I mean, that's a valid question, isn't it?
But we're getting them where we have to get them. That's the answer here. It is terrible. And we've talked at length in this program about the lack of a national program for manufacturing, procuring, and distributing these things. But I think you can't blame state, local, even the federal government for going after it. The worst thing that's happening right now is this competition among the different entities. It's driving up the price for everybody. I mean, if you want to start somewhere, that seems to me a place where we could impose some controls.
There were
price controls in World War II, and we keep saying this is war, so I would love to see some sort of control over the prices of this essential gear.
This is the scenario that Governor Cuomo has been talking about over the last several briefings, about states, say, going on eBay and outbidding other states for the equipment that they need. We also go to Daniel, who says the subject of his letter is Cuomo's double standard on landlords and renters. He writes, there has been a freeze on mortgages and foreclosures directly benefiting the more affluent in society. Why are renters being left out of this program? Does Governor Cuomo and other lawmakers assume that landlords will pass down the savings While the moratorium on evictions is helpful, rent freeze legislation needs to be passed as soon as possible. Thank you for taking the time and for everything that you do. That from Daniel.
Absolutely. I mean, what an important issue to discuss, because in essence, you cannot assume that people will simply do what's right. Some people will, but some people will not. And who will suffer the most? Those who have just lost their jobs in the gig economy, or those that are in the service industry and they have no other way of earning income. They have their families in apartments and now they can't make rent or pay any other utilities, or they're mostly focused on getting food on the table. So what should the governor do, but also put all payments for rent on hold for now?
Alan Chertok.
Well, easy for us to say that. And I agree that there's no question that those at the bottom of the economic pile get screwed the most. There's no question about it. Nevertheless, you know, you got a New York state government which is broke. And the theory, I'm sure, is that if you hit the owners hard with one kind of help, that they will pass that on to others who are renting from them. I don't necessarily buy that, that's for sure. But this is as American as apple pie, period.
Kyle, well, go ahead, Jim.
You know, the news that's been coming out about the Trump administration rewarding the states where the governors are his supporters
are red.
Is just disgusting.
Yeah. Does anybody remember, it seems to me, coming out of Philip Glotzbach, I'm going to ask you, because you may be, you know, have the best memory of this. Wasn't there a guy named Henry George? Does anybody remember that? Henry George? No, you don't.
Doesn't ring a bell, Alan.
Well, I think this guy was his whole
theory. An economist?
Yes. And his whole theory was, and I may be wrong, I know it's two first names. Maybe it's George Henry. No, it's Henry George.
Henry George.
Henry George. His whole theory was that people who owned would pass it down to the people who rent.
A single tax.
Single tax. That's right. So you tax real estate, and that's the way to do that.
It is. Yeah. And well.
Can I say something else? Because
sure.
I wanted to also mention, as a comparativist, I always feel compelled to say something about what's happening in other countries, because economic devastation is happening in many countries. So another wealthy country, Germany, has just implemented a policy. So when you need immediate assistance as a renter, as somebody who's lost a job, you can go online. It might take 24 to 48 hours to get through and file your paperwork. But then it only takes another day to get a deposit, a government deposit, into your check if you have a checking account. So that's how quickly some of the governments are reacting to giving money to small businesses or individuals that are struggling with current payments. Now, why it has to take so forever long in this country to actually mail out checks, it shows once again that our infrastructure in many ways is antiquated.
You know, I want to go back to the letters. Kyle asks a really good question, so I'll begin there. And he says, I know all of these measures going into place, schools being shut down, home orders needing to stay 6 feet away from people, et cetera, are to flatten the curve and to not overwhelm the hospitals. But what will happen in a few months from now? The virus will still be out there. It's hard to see life going back to normal.
That is a brilliant letter.
It really is.
Brilliant letter.
Because it's really hard to see what normal is, of how, because it's not like you're going to snap your fingers or flick a switch and all of a sudden you're going to be able, Alan, you brought up this point a couple days ago, that you're just going to be able to go into a theater with 5,000
right.
people.
I'm not going in a movie theater
right.
for a long time.
Exactly. And the only way we can go back to a movie theater or a theater performance or a concert or any of those things feeling confident is if everybody gets tested and we know who has antibodies, or we have immunization policies or something available that we can use to prevent another spread. So without testing, we will never return to what even is an assembly of what we used to consider normal life.
Yeah,
the
that's true. The,
yep.
it really emphasizes the importance of a vaccine. And when we have a vaccine, and I absolutely believe we'll have one, and I hope sooner rather than later, it'll be
will.
A game changer. Mm. But if you want a parallel, we look back to the recession of 2007, 2008. We are still feeling the effects of that. And one of the things we see is that a whole generation of students and parents, young people, were basically traumatized by that, and it shook their faith in the economic future. And I think that that is partially responsible for the kind of craziness that you see among college students today, not all of them, of course, and their parents, not all of them, but the concern that, you know, my kid's going to get out of college and not going to have a job and not going to have an economic future. And we're still seeing all that. So there's going to be something like that out of this experience that we've all shared, and we'll see how it plays out.
I'm sorry, but they know that the Tia Kreff guy called me just 2 days ago and said, "Stay with the program."
We have we just have about 2 minutes before we have to go or do a break. I'm going to read a couple of letters that I just refer to as rant letters. That's how I have collated them. And I don't say that in a derogative sense. I love these rants, but I just want to that's what they are. They're not really questions. They're just rants. And that's those are good. We want people to get out some of their rantness. So
Not on me.
No, not on you. No. or anyone on this panel, actually. Quinn says President Trump and his GOP administration need to be held accountable. I admit I'm just a layman when it comes to legal matters, but charges of criminal negligence, crimes against humanity, and manslaughter seem appropriate. My God, we are arresting people for coughing.
Yes.
We are arresting people for coughing on each other with malicious intent. Is the government exempt from charges when they perpetrated the spread of this virus? Rant number two is from Chris. Good morning, panel. Last week on the task force briefings, a reporter asked if the president has reached out to former presidents for advice and assistance. He pretty much scoffed at the idea, saying they weren't needed. Remember when Bush 43 reached out Bush 41 and President Clinton for help with tsunami relief efforts? Trump would never reach out to former presidents, especially Obama. After all, the greatest president in our history doesn't need any assistance. Rant number three comes from Charles, who says, yesterday I went to my local market here in Southern Dutchess County during the seniors only early shopping hour and observed quite a number of non-senior shopping. My understanding is that these early hours are for the most susceptible age group to not be exposed to the general public and perhaps to be able to shop in a less crowded and less hectic environment. To the people who are taking advantage of the honor system that this program operates under, I say, cut it out. Your sense of privileged entitlement is putting the most vulnerable of our citizens at risk. All right.
True again.
Three good rants. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have much more to discuss with our last 20 minutes or so. We have lots of letters. We welcome yours as well. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Jim Henler, and Philip Glotzbach. We will continue our conversation and talk about what's going on in the world after this short break. Last call on letters as we finish up our panel portion of the broadcast this morning. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Jim Henler, and Philip Glotzbach making up the panel. I'm Joe Donahue, and we thank you very much for being with us this morning. Let's go to some more letters. We have many, and I want to get as many in our last 15 minutes or so here. Lynn says, thanks for the great panel, and thanks for our daily dose of vitamins. You're like a booster of B12, the voices of sanity and adults in the room. I feel some political concern about the cargo plane from Russia. I can't help but be skeptical and wonder if this will be feeding the Trump narrative of the Russian hoax. Is he now going to declare his base how wonderful Russia is and that they did nothing to collude with him, but rather that the Russian plane and Putin are in fact our allies and friends and are trying to help us? This would fit his continual campaigning to his base. Alan.
Good letter.
Anybody else on that?
All I say absolutely, that is a real possibility, except for what I fear is that the coronavirus is right now causing mayhem in Russia, and they're also hiding their data.
Yep. All right. So, Jim, I'm sorry, did you want to say something?
I was just agreeing.
Oh, okay. That's allowed. We like that. As
sorry,
much as
sorry. I didn't mean to confuse people.
No, that's fine.
just think for a minute about Just think, Joe, for a minute about how, for all those years, the Russians were the enemy. Enemy, enemy, enemy. And who was picking it up? The people in the red states. Enemy. Terrible, terrible. Now, it's all turned around. The same guys who used to hate them are now being encouraged by this particular president to love them. It's unbelievable.
We have some letters with some opposing points of view. You will remember we read the rant of the shopper who was there during the senior hours. John says the writer of the last rant has no idea if those people who are not seniors are HIV positive, have cancer, or other immunocompromising diseases. Senior hours are for people who are vulnerable, not just seniors. Stop judging others. That is one counter letter. We also, you'll remember the one about renting that we read as well. Drew says it's so easy to say suspend rent payments as if landlords are all big corporations. I'm a retiree with one small rental property and I depend on that income. I will work with my tenants if they need help as well, but just saying rent payments should stop now ignores that landlords can be people too.
And that is why it's so important that the federal government actually extend a helping hand to all small businesses, including those who have a small rental unit, as well as those that can't pay their rent. This is not a time when we can simply say we'll help one group but not the other. Everybody who is in a difficult situation needs some assistance now, because if we want to go back to something like a functioning economy when we're through this period, everybody needs to be able to start up again.
Jim, I'm going to throw this one to you first, and then whoever wants it can have it. But could the panel unpack the data and assumptions contained in the model shown by the president's team 2 days ago, indicating that New York, in comparison with other states, was doing so poorly with respect to the projected number of cases per 100,000 population?
How many hours have we got? actually, let me make a blatant self-promotional thing. The institute that I run at Rensselaer, which you can find at idea.rpi.edu, if you click on the COVID page, big button right at the top, will take you to visualizations, data, code you could run to play with those things if you're computer literate. So lots of things. We're tracking everything we can get to make it so that people who want to play with this at the next level down can. Let me just say that, you know, what's feeding into those kind of numbers is exactly that New York is doing the right thing. We're testing more people. We're reporting honestly. We're showing what's really happening. And that makes numbers look worse. New York is the most packed city in the country. But even with all going on, you know, there's still life issues, right? The mass transit is something you can't turn off in New York City. And so what we really need is not just that data, but to drill down, understand, you know, if you look at the local Albany data and if you look at the New York City data, the spread looks very different. What a surprise. We're very different places. And, you know, when you lump these big states into one place, you get these very weird looking numbers. So we are trying our best to track all of this stuff. And I wish I could give you more detail, but suffice to say, those numbers are coming from a center like mine, but it's in state of Washington and much, much better funded. We take a lot of our information from them. They are the experts, and their numbers, you know, they're looking at everything they can. They're comparing things. They're doing what they can to try to make the numbers tell as honest a story as they can.
Give us the website just one more time.
So my website is idea.rpi.edu.
All right. People can find out more information there.
And a great big COVID button there for people who want to really look at this stuff for yourselves.
Elaine writes and says, I can only hope that Joe Biden's team is working hard on and unrolling soon a plan for social and economic recovery. We need to hear from the Dems very soon on this topic. Biden needs to get out there or get out of here. Then we go to this letter from Joanne, who says, please talk about the financial stress being put on our local hospitals and what is being done for them. Anybody want to talk about that? Philip, you have had some dealings, obviously, that you mentioned with Saratoga Hospital.
Well, they're certainly preparing right now, and I don't know the details. They're worried about the same things that came up earlier in the broadcast. They're worried about their people who are working shifts, who don't want to go home at night to potentially infect their families. They're worried about capacity. Should we be getting a surge? Everyone is looking at the curve in New York City and wondering if the upstate region, including the capital region, is next for this. So they're certainly trying to do that planning and working ahead. And God love them.
But on top of that, there is the governor answering questions about whether he's going to start bringing back down personnel from upstate New York to help in the pandemic downstate, and whether or not, and we saw a story, I believe, in the Times Union today about sending some people up.
Patients are coming up the north way, the thruway.
And if Great Barrington, I'm sorry to say, is any handle on this, people really don't want to see that happening. And that's too bad. But, I am seeing more than I want to see about, close the hatch. We're here. They're not. That's it.
I think it would be unrealistic for us not to imagine a future in which there are patients up here. The kind of hospitals that have been developed in Central Park or in the Javits Center or so on, it's just that may be in our future in this region as well. It may be in the future every place. We simply don't know. I hope that's not true, but I just think we don't know.
But it's already happening. That's the thing. I mean,
that's
we
right.
see it happening now.
Yeah.
So it's going to happen. And now we have to all be good to each other and stop the nonsense about close the hatch.
And as the governor pointed out,
kindness is important.
Absolutely. And the governor pointed out yesterday that, we're still 2 weeks away from seeing the apex of this in New York. So, it's going to get a lot worse before it gets any better. Francis writes to us and says, I think the Trump daily update and let me try this again. I think that Trump's daily updates are becoming more like a Trump rally. After the experts do their presentations and state facts of informative information, it becomes a time for Trump to bloviate and dodge pertinent questions by babbling on what a great job that he is doing.
That's right. I mean, that's absolutely right. However, I think the reporters have to get a lot of commendation for what they're doing. They are asking the scientific question of the scientists, and it is so clear that he cannot stand that. He comes literally running in and pushes them aside. Terrible.
Tony says the subject of the note being nationalized USA healthcare single payer now. We need to nationalize healthcare single payer. Ireland just did it. We need a national leader like Cuomo as soon as possible, or Bernie Sanders with effective advisors. Our country is tanking. Thanks for your show and thanks for WAMC. Anyone on that?
Well, I mean, the news that Trump will be closing down access to Obamacare, and this is deeply worrying at a time when everybody needs access to health care and at the lowest possible cost or at no cost. It's shocking to hear that there are thinking going on to privatize, to eliminate, to exclude. That is the exact opposite of what we need right now.
In the time that we have left, one of the issues that we talked about early on in the program, and I wanted to circle back to it, is, Philip, you mentioned that colleges got billions in the Corona relief bill, but also that it fell far short of the needs of colleges. So what should the next step be?
Well, like every other segment of the economy, we're worried about the future, and our colleges and universities more vulnerable than some other industries. I don't know, perhaps in some cases. I think we do have colleges and universities, smaller liberal arts colleges, some in some places, more regional ones, may face this is an existential moment for them. Others are going to take an awful long time to recover from the economic effects of this. It would certainly be helpful if the if there were some additional federal aid forthcoming. I was pleased that the bill that was just passed included private independent colleges and universities along with the state systems. I think that was enormously important because private colleges and everybody on this panel is at a private college. We educate an enormous number of students across the country.
Not me.
Except for you, Alan. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. At Albany, right. State University at Albany. Yes, almost everyone. Sorry.
But so I wanted to agree with Phil that just like Skidmore, Siena College is also returning money to students for housing and food costs. That is, of course, a very large payment back, I think around $4 million. And in addition to that, I have lots of students now that I'm advising, that I'm speaking with through our Zoom technology, who are helping support their parents. I have one student who's driving her brother into New York City, into Manhattan. He's an iron worker assigned to building hospitals. I have another student in Massachusetts whose parents are in the health industry, and she's cooking at home for everybody and taking care of the younger siblings. I mean, they're incredible challenges, and they're all thinking about what will the future hold? How can I go back to college? Can I finish this semester under the strains that I'm experiencing? Will my parents, who might have lost positions or are restructured, will I be able to return to college in the fall? These are absolutely fundamental questions.
Jim, we have about a minute and a half. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, you know, we like most universities, are also looking at the future and doing serious financial planning because enrollment numbers have already been dropping in this region. But with this, you know, just people being able to afford college is going to be harder. Many people who we would expect in our, you know, to be accepting, you know, come to a campus day to compare campuses. This year, we've had to try to figure out how to move that virtual. So I think all the universities in the Northeast particularly, but around the country, are very worried about future enrollment numbers and items like that. And that's going to really have a significant impact that this first infusion of cash will, you know, won't be addressing.
All right,
absolutely.
Friend. Go ahead.
I'll just say quickly, no one knows what the admissions world looks like this year. We have no idea how it's all going to turn out. And Jim is absolutely right. And Vera's point about, you know, there are so many students in college and at university these days who are just on the edge financially, and they're receiving enormous amounts of financial aid. We have those students too, and they return home to sometimes pretty desperate situations. And so there are just a lot of trauma and challenge to go around. We'll have to see how we can sort it all out.
My friends, we are out of time, but I thank you so much for being with us and for sharing your insights. It is always welcome and appreciated, and I thank you all. We'll return with the roundtable after this short break.